A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis. Chapter 2. For the first time, I have looked back and read these notes. They appall me. From the way I have been talking, anyone would think that H.'s death mattered chiefly for its effect on myself. Her point of view seems to have dropped out of sight. Have I forgotten the moment of bitterness when she cried out, "And there was so much to live for"? Happiness had not come to her early in life. A 1,000 years of it would not have made her blasé. Her palate for all the joys of sense and intellect and spirit was fresh and unspoiled. Nothing would have been wasted on her. She liked more things and liked them more than anyone I have known. A noble hunger, long unsatisfied, met at last its proper food, and almost instantly the food was snatched away. Fate, or whatever it is, delights to produce a great capacity and then frustrate it. Beethoven went deaf. By our standards, a mean joke. The monkey trick of a spiteful imbecile. I must think more about H and less about myself. Yes, that sounds very well, but there's a snag. I am thinking about her nearly always, thinking of the H facts. Real worlds, looks, laughs, and actions of hers. But in my own mind, that selects and groups them. Already less than a month after her death, I can feel the slow, insidious beginning of a process that will make the H I think of into a more and more imaginary woman. Founded on fact, no doubt, I shall put in nothing fictitious, or I hope I shan't. But won't the composition inevitably become more and more my own? The reality is no longer there to check me, to pull me up short, as the real H so often did, so unexpectedly, by being so thoroughly herself, and not me. The most precious gift that marriage gave me was this constant impact of something very close and intimate, yet all the time unmistakably other, resistant, in a word, real. Is all that work to be undone? Is what I shall still call H to sink back horribly into being not much more than one of my old bachelor pipe dreams? Oh, my dear, come back for one moment and drive that miserable phantom away. Oh, God, God, why did you take such trouble to force this creature out of its shell if it is now doomed to crawl back, to be sucked back into it? Today, I had to meet a man I haven't seen for 10 years. And all that time I had thought I was remembering him well. How he looked and spoke, and the sort of things he said. The first 5 minutes of the real man shattered the image completely. Not that he had changed. On the contrary, I kept on thinking, yes, of course, of course. I'd forgotten that he thought that, or disliked this, or knew so-and-so, or jerked his head this way and that. I had known all these things once, and I recognized them the moment I met them again. But they had all faded out of my mental picture of him, and when they were all replaced by his actual presence, the total effect was quite astonishingly different from the image I had carried about with me for these 10 years. How can I hope that this will not happen to my memory of H? That it is not happening already, slowly, quietly, like snowflakes, like the small flakes that come when it's going to snow all night. Little flakes of me, my impressions, my selections, are settling down on the image of her. The real shape will be quite hidden in the end. 10 minutes, 10 seconds of the real H would correct all this. And yet, even if those 10 seconds were allowed me, 1 second later, the little flakes would begin to fall again. The rough, sharp, cleansing tang of her otherness is gone. What pitiable cant to say she will live forever in my memory. Live? This is exactly what she won't do. You might as well think like the old Egyptians that you can keep the dead by embalming them. Will nothing persuade us that they are gone? What's left? A corpse, a memory, and in some versions a ghost. All mockeries are horrors. 3 more ways of spelling the word dead. It was H I loved, as if I wanted to fall in love with my memory of her, an image in my own mind. It would be a sort of incest. I remember being rather horrified one summer morning long ago when a burly, cheerful labouring man, carrying a hoe and a watering pot, came into our churchyard, and, as he pulled the gate behind him, shouted over his shoulder to two friends, "See you later, I'm going to visit Mum." He meant he was going to weed and water and generally tidy up her grave. It horrified me, because this mode of sentiment, all this churchyard stuff, was and is simply hateful, even inconceivable to me. But in light of my recent thoughts, I'm beginning to wonder whether, if one could take that man's line, "I can't," there isn't a good deal to be said for it. A 6x3 foot flowerbed had become Mum. That was his symbol for her, his link with her. Caring for it was visiting her. May this not be in one way better than preserving and caressing an image in one's own memory? The grave and image are equally links with the irrecoverable and symbols for the unimaginable. But the image has the added disadvantage that it will do whatever you want. It will smile or frown, be tender, gay, or argumentative, just as your mood demands. It is a puppet of which you hold the strings. Not yet, of course, the reality is still too fresh. Genuine and wholly involuntary memories can still, thank God, at any moment rush in and tear the strings out of my hands. But the fatal obedience of the image, its insipid dependence on me, is bound to increase. The flowerbed, on the other hand, is an obstinate, resistant, often intractable bit of reality. Just as Mum in her lifetime doubtless was, as H was, or as H is. Can I honestly say that I believe she now is anything the vast majority of the people I meet, say, at work, would certainly think she is not? Though naturally, they wouldn't press the point on me. Not just now, anyway. What do I really think? I have always been able to pray for the other dead, and I still do, with some confidence. But when I try to pray for H, I halt. Bewilderment and amazement come over me. I have a ghastly sense of unreality, of speaking into a vacuum about a non-entity. The reason for the difference is only too plain. You never know how much you really believe anything until its truth or falsehood becomes a matter of life and death to you. It is easy to say you believe a rope to be strong and sound as long as you are merely using it to cord a box. But suppose you were to hang by that rope over a precipice. Wouldn't you then first discover how much you really trusted it? The same with people. For years, I would have said that I had perfect confidence in BR. Then came the moment when I had to decide whether I would or would not trust him with a really important secret. That threw quite a new light on what I called my confidence in him. I discovered that there was no such thing, only a real risk tests the reality of a belief. Apparently the faith, I thought it faith, which enables me to pray for the other dead, has seemed strong only because I have never really cared, not desperately, whether they existed or not, yet I thought it did. But there are other difficulties. Where is she now? That is, in what place is she at the present time? But if H is not a body, and the body I loved is certainly no longer she, she's in no place at all, and present time is a date or point in our time series. It is as if she were on a journey without me. And I said, looking at my watch, "I wonder, is she at Euston Station now?" But unless she is proceeding at 60 seconds a minute along the same timeline that we all living people travel by, what does now mean? If the dead are not in time, are not in our sort of time, is there any clear difference when we speak of them between was and is and will be? Kind people have said to me, "She is with God." In one sense, that is most certain. She is, like God, incomprehensible and unimaginable. But I find that this question, however important it may be in itself, is not after all very important in relation to grief. Suppose that the earthly lives she and I shared for a few years are in reality only the basis for, or prelude to, our earthly appearance of two unimaginable super cosmic eternal somethings. Those somethings could be pictured as spheres or globes, where the planet of nature cuts through them, that is, in earthly life, they appear as two circles that touched. But those two circles, above all, the point at which they touched, are the very thing I am mourning for, homesick for, famished for. You tell me, she goes on, but my heart and body are crying out, come back, come back. Be a circle, touching my circle, on the plane of nature. But I know this is impossible. I know that the thing I want is exactly the thing I can never get. The old life, the jokes, the drinks, the arguments, the love-making, the tiny heart-breaking commonplace. On any view whatever, to say H is dead is to say all that is gone. It is a part of the past, and the past is the past, and that is what time means, and time itself is one more name for death. And heaven itself is a state where the former things have passed away. Talk to me about the truth of religion, and I'll listen gladly. Talk to me about the duty of religion, and I'll listen submissively. But don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you don't understand. Unless, of course, you can literally believe all that stuff about family reunions on the other shore, pictured on entirely earthly terms. But that is all unscriptural, all out of bad hymns and lithographs. There's not a word of it in the Bible, and it rings false. We know it couldn't be like that. Reality never repeats. The exact same thing is never taken away and given back. How well the spiritualists bait their hook. Things on this side are not so different after all. There are cigars in heaven. For that is what we should all like, the happy past restored. And that, just that, is what I cry out for, with mad midnight endearments and entreaties spoken into the empty air. And poor C quotes to me, do not mourn like those that have no hope. It astonishes me the way we are invited to apply to ourselves words so obviously addressed to our betters. What St. Paul says can comfort only those who love God better than the dead, and the dead better than themselves. If a mother is mourning, not for what she has lost, but for what her dead child has lost, it is a comfort to believe that the child has not lost the end for which it was created. And it is a comfort to believe that she herself, in losing her chief or only natural happiness, has not lost a greater thing, that she may still hope to glorify God and enjoy him forever. A comfort to the God aimed eternal spirit within her, but not to her motherhood. The specifically maternal happiness must be written off. Never in any place or time will she have her son on her knees, or bathe him, or tell him a story, or plan for his future, or see her grandchild. They tell me H is happy now. They tell me she is at peace. What makes them so sure of this? I don't mean that I fear the worst of all. Nearly her last words were, I am at peace with God. She had not always been, and she never lied. And she wasn't easily deceived, least of all in her own favour. I don't mean that. But why are they so sure that all anguish ends with death? More than half the Christian world and millions in the East believe otherwise. How do they know she is at rest? Why should the separation, if nothing else, which so agonizes the lover who is left behind, be painless to the lover who departs? Because she is in God's hands. But if so, she was in God's hands all the time. And I have seen what they did to her here. Do they suddenly become gentler to us the moment we are out of the body? And if so, why? If God's goodness is inconsistent with hurting us, then either God is not good, or there is no God. For in the only life we know, he hurts us beyond our worst fears and beyond all we can imagine. If it is consistent with hurting us, then he may hurt us after death as endurably as before it. Sometimes It is hard not to say, God, forgive God. Sometimes it is hard to say so much. But if our faith is true, he didn't. He crucified him. Come, what do we gain by evasions? We are under the harrow and can't escape. Reality looked at steadily is unbearable. And how or why did such a reality blossom or fester here? And there into the terrible phenomenon called consciousness. Why did it produce things like us, who can see it, and seeing it, recoil on loathing, who, stranger still, want to see it, and take pains to find it out, even though, when no one compels them, and even though the sight of it makes an incurable ulcer in their hearts, people like hate yourself, who would have truth at any price. If H is not, then she never was. I mistook a cloud of atoms for a person. There aren't and never were any people. Death only reveals the vacuity that was always there. What we call the living are simply those who have not yet been unmasked, all equally bankrupt, but some not yet declared. But this must be nonsense. Vacuity revealed to whom? Bankruptcy declared to whom? To other boxes or fireworks or clouds of atoms? I will never believe, more strictly I can't believe, that one set of physical events could be or make a mistake about other sets. No, my real fear is not of materialism. If it were true, we, or what we mistake for we, could get out, get from under the harrow. An overdose of sleeping pills would do it. I am more afraid that we are really rats in a trap, or worse still, rats in a laboratory. Someone said, I believe, God always geometrizes, supposing the truth were God always vivisects. Sooner or later I must face the question in plain language. What reason have we, except our own desperate wishes, to believe that God is, by any standard we can conceive, good? Doesn't all the prima facie evidence suggest exactly the opposite? What have we to set against it? We set Christ against it. But how if he were mistaken? Almost his last words may have a perfect, clear meaning. He had found that the being he called Father was horribly and infinitely different from what he had supposed. The trap, so long and carefully prepared and so subtly baited, was at last sprung on the cross. The vile, practical joke had succeeded. What chokes every prayer and every memory, is the memory of all the prayers H and I offered and all the false hopes we had. No hopes, not hopes raised merely by our own wishful thinking, hopes encouraged, even forced upon us, by false diagnosis, by x-ray photographs, by strange remissions, by one temporary recovery that might have ranked as a miracle. Step by step, we were led up the garden path. Time after time, when he seemed most gracious, he was really preparing the next torture. I wrote that last night. It was a yell rather than a thought. Let me try it over again. Is it rational to believe in a bad God? Anyway, in a God so bad as all that? The cosmic sadist, despiteful imbecile? I think it is, if nothing else, too anthropomorphic. When you come to think of it, it is far more anthropomorphic than picturing him as a grave old king with a long beard. That image is a Jungian archetype. It links God with all the wise old kings in the fairy tales, with prophets, sages, magicians. Though it is, formally, the picture of a man, it suggests something more than humanity. At the very least, it gets in the idea of something older than yourself, something that knows more, something you can't fathom. It preserves mystery, therefore room for hope, therefore room for a dread or awe that needn't be more, mere fear of mischief from a spiteful potentate. But the picture I was building up last night is simply the picture of a man like S.C., who used to sit next to me at dinner and tell what he'd been doing to the cats that afternoon. Now, being like S.C., however magnified, couldn't invent or create or govern anything, he would set traps and try to bait them. but he'd never have thought of baits like love or laughter or daffodils or a frosty sunset. He make a universe? He couldn't make a joke or a bow or an apology or a friend. Or could one seriously introduce the idea of a bad God as if it were the back door through a sort of extreme Calvinism? You could say we are fallen and depraved. We are so depraved that our idea of goodness count for nothing, or worse than nothing. The very fact that we think something good is presumptive evidence that it is really bad. Now God has, in fact, our worst fears are true, all the characteristics we regard as bad: unreasonableness, vanity, vindictiveness, injustice, cruelty. But all these blacks, as they seem to us, are really whites. It's only our depravity makes them look black to us. And so what? This, for all practical and speculative purposes, sponges God off the slate. The word good applied to him becomes meaningless, like abracadabra. We have no motive for obeying him, not even fear. It is true we have his threats and promises, but why should we believe them? If cruelty is, from his point of view, good, telling lies may be good too. Even if they are true, what then? If his ideas of good are so very different from ours, what he calls heaven might well be what we should call hell, and vice versa. Finally, if reality at its very root is so meaningless to us, or putting it the other way around, if we are such total imbeciles, what is the point of trying to think about either God or about anything else? This knot becomes undone when you try to pull it tight. Why do I make room in my mind for such filth and nonsense? Do I hope that a feeling disguises itself as thought I should feel less? Aren't all these notes the senseless writhings of a man who won't accept the fact that there is nothing we can do with suffering except to suffer it? Who still thinks there is some device, if only he could find it, which will make pain not to be pain? It doesn't really matter whether you grip the arms of the dentist's chair or let your hands lie in your lap. The drill drills on, and the grief still feels like fear, perhaps more strictly like suspense, or like waiting, just hanging about, waiting for something to happen. It gives life a permanently provisional feeling. It doesn't seem worth starting anything. I can't settle down. I yawn, I fidget, I smoke too much. Up till this, I always had too little time. Now there is nothing but time, almost pure time, empty successiveness, one flesh, or if you prefer, one ship. The starboard engine is gone. I, the port engine, must chug along somehow till we make harbour, or rather, till the journey ends. How can I assume a harbour, a lee shore more likely, a black night, a deafening gale, breakers ahead, and any lights shown from the land probably being waved by wreckers? Such was H's landfall. Such was my mother's. I say their landfalls, not their arrivals.